Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, July 31st. Let's play a game. Guess the date of what I'm describing here. Springtime protests break out among a rare coalition of black civil rights activists and white liberals and radicals. The protests are overwhelmingly peaceful, but some people do commit acts of violence. Police acting in concert with the president, who has authoritarian tendencies, make mass arrests of protesters, including peaceful ones. It's unclear if the protests are accomplishing their goals. Well, if you are choosing between a date in April or a date in May or a date in June, if it sounds like it could be from just about any day in the last 2 months, here's the punchline. It was from the spring of 1971. There are some eerie parallels as well as differences for different causes at different times, right? What can we learn, though, from the spring of 71? A new book takes us back there, and the author can tie it to today. With us now is the author, investigative journalist Lawrence Roberts. He's been senior editor at ProPublica, investigations editor of the Washington Post, executive editor of the Huffington Post Investigative Fund, projects editor at the Hartford Current, foreign correspondent for the wire service United Press International, and more. The book is called May Day 1971, A White House at War, A Revolt in the Streets, and the Untold Story of America's Biggest Mass Arrest. Lawrence, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian, and thanks for having me.
Obviously, you wrote this book before the police killing of George Floyd triggered today's protest movement. What got you interested in writing a whole book about 1971 now?
Yeah, the parallels are very surprising, right? I mean, when I started work on the book about 5 years ago, Barack Obama was in the White House. I certainly didn't imagine that when it came out, I'd be talking about the lessons it holds for another social movement and for another embattled president who's facing re-election. Now, it seemed to me, though, that even though the protests over the Vietnam War were part of one of the great mass movements in American history, along with civil rights, the labor movement, and the women's movement, it had sort of faded in historical memory, and especially faded was the extraordinary situation in Washington in 1971. Many of the people and forces that were rocking the country throughout the 60s converged on Washington in that season, and I just felt that was a story that deserved to be revived.
Today's Black Lives Matter protests have the very broad goal of attacking the massive and persistent racial inequalities in this country that we call systemic racism. That covers so many things, from education to housing to employment to criminal justice and more. How much was the uprising of 1971 more singly focused on ending the Vietnam War?
It was pretty singly focused on the Vietnam War. I mean, some of these other issues, racism and women's rights, gay rights, were in the air and were part of it, but it was a very focused kind of demonstration. Yeah, in the case of Richard Nixon in 71, unlike the Black Lives Matter demonstrations now, the precipitating incident was the president's geographic expansion of the Vietnam War. He had just announced that he was sending the war over the border into Laos, and he was expanding the conflict after being elected in part, on a promise to bring the fighting to an end. By then, the war had been grinding on for 6 years. It wasn't at the peak of the fighting anymore, but every week, dozens of American soldiers were still dying in the jungle. Thousands of Southeast Asians were dying. So that spring, a lot of different anti-war groups all decided to act more or less together, and they came to Washington in droves for a series of protests. You had the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, you had Quakers, civil rights leaders, masses of students, and they saw it as possibly the last best chance to pressure Nixon into ending the war, and it turned out to be the most intense season of dissent in the history of Washington. And one of the reasons it was so intense is that it included the biggest act of civil disobedience in U.S. history. This was the action known as May Day, followed by the biggest mass arrest in U.S. history.
On actual May Day, May 1st?
Yes, the May Day action took place. It was the finale of this long season. It took place over 3 days, starting on Monday, the 3rd of May, and went through Wednesday, the 5th of May, and in the end, there were 12,000 people arrested, which remains the biggest mass arrest.
Lawrence, tell us about that mass arrest.
Well, let me paint a little bit of a picture for you there. So on the first weekend in May of 71, down by the banks of the Potomac River in D.C., on national parkland, this group that called itself the May Day Tribe gathered. And these were mostly young folks, people in their teens and 20s. They made up, you know, one slice of the anti-war movement, which was very broad. They were perhaps the most impatient slice. The movement had already accomplished a lot, by the way, by then. By 71, it was already, I think, the most effective anti-war movement the world had ever seen. It brought millions of people into the streets, as you say, from, you know, starting really from 65 all the way to 71. Thousands of draftees had burned their draft cards or left for Canada to avoid being sent to Vietnam. And the movement, of course, forced Nixon's predecessor, Lyndon Johnson, to give up running for re-election.
But it didn't end the war, right? It didn't end the war to that point, which is part of the premise of the book, right?
This is true, and this is why there was this, you know, tactical debate within the movement about what should be the next step to put more pressure on the government. So for months, this group, which was led by two guys, one Rennie Davis, who was a former organizer for Students for Democratic Society, SDS, and David Dellinger, who was a longtime pacifist involved in the peace movement, came up with this idea for a mass act of civil disobedience, you know, to a more direct action than just a march. And their slogan was, if the government won't stop the war, we'll stop the government. So thousands of people came into D.C. They streamed into that park. You know, the 60s and early 70s was not just a time of political upheaval. There was also a cultural revolution going on. So you had, you know, in this park, there were 50,000 people there by the weekend, you know, coming in their Volkswagen Beetles and microbuses parked all over the place. They erected tents and lean-tos. There was music and dogs and, you know, frisbees and, of course, recreational drugs. You know, the top songs on the radio were, you know, one of them was What's Going On by Marvin Gaye. It was just a full spectrum of, you know, fear and rage and alienation and hope, and live music in the park, by the way. They put on an all-day, all-night rock concert to kind of draw everybody in. Even the Beach Boys were there. It was quite the scene, and it unnerved the Nixon people. So that's all a way, by introduction, to say that the Nixon and his folks were holding what I call war councils before this in order to figure out how to keep this event, the civil disobedience, from being a success, because they saw it as a political threat. And they planned to find ways to stop, to stop it from being something that looked like it was triumphing over the government. So Nixon ordered secretly the police to, you know, clear the streets. And he called in the military, in another sort of echo of today. 10,000 troops were summoned to the city. One of the great moments, I think, that stick in my mind of that time was these gigantic Chinook helicopters landing on the Washington Monument, you know, with flares, smoke flares, and then, you know, troops from the 82nd Airborne, you know, coming out of the choppers and running off through the city. I mean, it was quite a scene for what's supposed to be a, you know, democratic republic. And then once the civil disobedience got underway on Monday morning rush hour, the police were quickly overwhelmed and abandoned all the normal arrest procedures that they had in place. And just basically began sweeping people up in a dragnet. And by the end of the day on Monday, they had, 7,000 people locked up. They filled all the jail cells to overflowing. Then they filled the jail yards to overflowing. And then they set up a temporary detention camp on a football field surrounded by a 8-foot cyclone fence, outside in the city, and then moved thousands more inside the Washington Coliseum, where they spent the night on the floor. you know, where they normally play hockey or hold the circus or something like that. And later on, you know, after all the smoke had settled and the courts had a chance to look at all this, all these arrests and detentions were declared unconstitutional, and the people who were arrested ended up, you know, getting paid millions of dollars altogether in compensation.
Let's hear some memories. Ross in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ross. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you for taking my call. I was in the United States Navy from the fall 66 to early winter 1970. I was a hospital corpsman. I worked with the wounded in Bethesda and in Maryland. Now, listen to what happened. I went there and I stayed for 2 days. We occupied the city. The city never slept. There was millions of people. And the second day, I and many, many veterans were allowed to come into the White House, up the lawn, and the president was there with Marines around him, and they had baskets, and we took our ribbons off, and we told them, we don't want these ribbons, you have to stop the war. Now, the third day, the word came around that the army was coming in. The guys from New York got back on the buses and got out. The Civil Liberties Union had a case against the government. It took them 7 years. Every man and woman arrested got $11,000 in a settlement.
Ross, thank you very much. Is that the same settlement money you were talking about before the break, Lawrence?
Yes, it was. You know, not everybody who was arrested got a settlement, and not everybody got a big check, but thousands of people did.
Christine in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Hi, Christine. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Hi, Brian. I was also there. I was, at the time, a politically active teenager living in Indiana, and I rode in the back of a U-Haul truck with some other activist types to the demonstration, and my memories are mostly of chaos and fear, like a lot of running from the police, a lot of tear gas, a lot of hovering helicopters. When I see Portland, of course I have flashbacks, but I'm amazed to hear now about all the numbers of arrests. I just had no awareness of that at the time. Just like ending up in a church in, you know, that gave us sanctuary, you know, to keep us safe. So it was a wild time. I'm glad I went, and I continue to demonstrate constantly.
Does your demonstration experience from then inform sort of how you protest today, or how you connect with other people around protesting today, or anything like that?
Well, even though, you know, I've been tempted at times to take a different route, I've always kept with a nonviolent approach. And, but I've seen firsthand many, many times, like police running amok with people that are doing no harm other than expressing their voice. And, you know, and it's not a joke. It's just constantly being, you know, suppressed in that way, you know, I've been arrested, not there, but, you know, I've been arrested in New York City, you know, and I guess I've always been the same person since, you know, but it saddens me that the same things continue.
Christine, thank you so much for your call. Steve in West Orange, you're on WNYC. Hi, Steve.
Good morning, Brian. In 1970, I had been working with Dan Berrigan, and we produced a record album of his poetry just in time for his Passover Seder mysterious appearance at Cornell and disappearance in front of 100 FBI agents and about 10,000 people.
And for people who don't know the name, that's Catholic priest and poet Daniel Berrigan, right?
Yes, exactly.
Go ahead.
Of course, the FBI
anti-war
agents there were wearing very much so, very much so. The FBI agents there were wearing serapes with penny loafers, so everybody knew who they were, and pennies in the penny loafers. But then I came down to the demonstration in Washington to cover it for the television station in Ithaca, where I had been in school, and I had my camera, I had a press card, I had a press helmet. And nonetheless, we were all rounded up late at night and hustled into the precinct house. I think it was on 6th Street in Washington. Fortunately, I was able to keep my camera. They were so busy, they didn't bother to take our stuff from us. And so I was able to document it a little bit, which I later used in a film. But it was a wild night with people just pouring in. Maybe there were maybe 10 people in the cell. And then on the way out of Washington, I remember that after we had been given a ticket, citation, we were driving out in a Volkswagen van, as your guest said, and I pointed at a policeman and I like shot my finger, and we just kept going quickly because I think he was pretty upset. But I'll tell you that the tenor of the times was such that the Jefferson Airplane song about we are all outlaws in the eyes of America, in order mm-hmm. to survive, we steal, et cetera, et cetera. And that has sort of stayed with me. And I have to say that to some extent I have retained a hostility towards the police. Not every police person. I've had courteous police people stop me, and when they've been courteous, I've been courteous. But I am all too ready to hold those authoritarians responsible.
And what do you think about what's going on today with the memories that you have?
Well, it's easy to see why people need to have some civility in the cities, and it's easy to see how a few people determined to start a problem can do that. I mean, it seemed to me as though the president was offering bait for his television commercials when he sent people into Portland. That seemed to be like the most obvious thing that was going to happen, and it did.
Steve, thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate it. So a set of pretty interesting callers there. Any thoughts, hearing some of the people reflect back on that time and with respect to today?
Yeah, it's very interesting that in the many people I spoke with in my research for the book who were around in that time or participated in a demonstration, it really stood out for them as a big part of their lives, which was in contrast to kind of the historical record, which had sort of forgotten this demonstration. One of the reasons it faded, the May Day 1971 era faded in everybody's memory, was that it was immediately followed by these two, very huge stories. One was the release of the Pentagon Papers, which happened just weeks after all these mass arrests. And then, of course, that led to Watergate. And, that became kind of the signature of in people's minds of what happened during the Nixon administration. But I did find that people who were part of the anti-war movement, keep that quite close to their hearts. And even though, as you make the point, which is fair, that the movement, didn't itself end the war, or at least didn't end the war soon enough, it's a lot of people see their involvement in that as a great success because it was a manifestation of the need to express your dissent.
The Nixon side of the story. The Wall Street Journal has, I'm sure you saw it, a very positive review of your book, and mentions that in your research you found some overlooked White House tapes of the angry, frustrated President Nixon urging some disturbing ways to undo the protesters, and that you quote Nixon in what the reviewer calls a self-aware frame of mind, reflecting on his decision to Bob Haldeman, his chief of staff. He says, quote, "Bob, let me tell you what happened. We arrested a hell of a lot of people. In a strictly legal sense, it was not legal, but we had to do it. Now, that's all there is to it, and we'll do it again, because keeping this government going is more important than screwing around." So you want to elaborate on that? They were trying to physically shut the government down in some way, this mass protest, right?
Yeah, it was a traffic blockade, right? I mean, they weren't.
That's all?
It was talked about as, if the government, won't stop the war, we'll stop the government. But I don't, it would be wrong to think of it as an attempt to sort of overthrow the government. The idea was just to create enough, chaos in the city that would perhaps spark A series of demonstrations around the country, similar to what you're seeing happen today. I think that was in their minds, right? If we started having successful civil disobedience in D.C., it might, end up being a more even bigger mass movement that would actually force people's hands. Mm-hmm. But I would say, in terms of Nixon, I would say my biggest finding was how he and his men kind of turned that season into a laboratory for the schemes that they would soon direct against their political enemies in the 72 campaign. And at the time, their role in the May Day mass arrests, and I should say, too, something I wanted to emphasize listening to everybody, during the dragnet that pulled in 12,000 people over 3 days, thousands of those people were not breaking any laws. Like, some people were blocking in the streets, but once they decided to do this dragnet, which Nixon had encouraged, they just swept through the streets picking up anyone who had long hair, was wearing the wrong political button, or was dressed in hippie clothes. You know, they'd literally drive the buses through the streets, and if they saw somebody who didn't look right, they'd send out a cop to go drag them onto the bus. I mean, it was really stretched any constitutional norms. So, Nixon's role at the time was widely suspected, but it was never proven. It really was the first cover-up by the White House. And what they were doing around the May Day time and around the whole period of spring 71, when all these different groups came to D.C., they used illegal wiretaps, they played dirty tricks, they infiltrated the ranks of the protesters. And to my mind, this is when they learned how to ignore the rule of law with impunity, because at first they thought they'd won the day. They managed to keep their role secret. And it became kind of, because it seemed to work out for them initially, I think it encouraged them to use some of the same techniques and the same people in the coming months against Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers, and then against the Democrats. And that, of course, led to Watergate, and we know how that turned out for them.
Yeah. Do you think Trump learned lessons from Richard Nixon's behavior at that time for anything he's doing today?
I'm not sure what the president's learned from that. But I think there's one big difference between now and then. I mean, there are obviously a lot of similarities in that, faced with the social movement, the option of calling in, military force to confront them. But the difference was that Nixon and his folks, some level, felt this was, politically problematic, if not legally problematic, and kept it secret, kept the role out of it. The current president is not doing anything to hide his involvement in calling out federal agents or trying to call out troops, even against the wishes of the Pentagon, to confront the demonstrators today.
Let's take one more call, because I think we now have a caller on the line who was there on May Day 1971, Maria in California. Maria, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Good morning. Yes, I was there on May 1st, 1971. I was just home from the Peace Corps. I was ashamed of what my country was doing in Vietnam. I went down to Washington. I immediately got involved with an affinity group of other demonstrators from New York. I remember running through the streets being chased by police who were wielding batons. And if they caught, I saw them, when they caught people, they would start beating them with batons. And we were all just young people. It didn't matter, girls, boys, you were going to get beaten. So I was running through the streets, and suddenly somebody grabbed me. And the next thing I knew, I was in this kind of ramshackle house, and it was a black family, and they had pulled me in to protect me, and they sheltered me there. I stayed there for several hours, and then I went back out onto the streets, and again I was thrown into this chaos, and I was taken to jail and put in a cell with about a dozen other women. And then I was in there about 12 hours, and I got called out of the cell. The other women still stayed there, but anyway, I got called out, and I was taken before a judge. There was chaos in this courtroom. There were hundreds of people. Suddenly, I'm in front of the judge, and he looks at me, and he goes, "Are you pregnant?" And I thought that was the weirdest question, but I knew there had to be something to it. So I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "Get out of here." So, okay, I got out, and I continued out, and it was something. Even talking about it makes me very stressed.
Even to this day.
Yeah, to this day. I'm 74 years old now, and I continue to be active as much as I can. But that was just chaos. I feel like our country is on the verge of a civil war.
Is this the biggest season of protests since then in your life?
I think so.
Maria, thank you so much. And Lawrence Roberts, will end with that question for you, and we have 30 seconds.
Yes, I think it is the biggest series of protests that we've seen since then. And how it plays out is really important, because it gets down to the nature of dissent and the right of dissent in a democracy. And it's easy to give lip service to the Bill of Rights, but it's much harder to respect those rules when the country's being rocked by social change. And I think it brings out the true character of the government.
Investigative reporter Lawrence Roberts has written a book called May Day 1971, A White House at War, A Revolt in the Streets, and the Untold Story of America's Biggest Mass Arrest. He's going to be doing some virtual book events in August. You can find it on his website. Lawrence Roberts, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian, for having me on the show.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.